I'm Jonathan Goldstein, host of Wiretap. Each week you're invited to listen in on my telephone conversations, whether funny, sad, wistful, or even slightly strange. You never know just what you might hear on Wiretap.
I mean, I knew you had a show. I just didn't think that people actually listen to it.
Howard,
that's the breadth of your genius, Jonathan. It's not just that you're funny, but you can be cripplingly, poignantly depressing.
The Wiretap Archives, available on CBC Listen, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. This is a CBC podcast.
Being on fire.
Whew. This is a Hollywood stunt performer and designer about to describe what it's like to be set on fire.
It's super weird.
Weird and dangerous.
For a full fire burn, you're just lathered in gel, your face, your hair, and completely soaked. So you're freezing. You put this generic man's face, like horror movie type looking mask that goes on top of you. So now you're like, can't hear. You're just inside of this mask. I have a breathing tube that they put through the mask so that you can breathe. And that's mostly to just calm yourself. It's like a meditative breath. Because once you're on fire, you cannot breathe. Because you'd be inhaling, and that's how a lot of people get injured.
Three, two, one, action, coming up.
It's warm, but you're okay. I could see like red a little bit, but other than that, it just becomes like your heart. It's important to stay calm, but it's very claustrophobic. So now you're completely in this thing and you hear people murmuring, but you can't hear anything else. You're just completely on fire, and it feels like it takes forever, but it's, 10 seconds. And then they come in, you hear more murmuring, and they, like, you'll feel someone put you on the ground, they put you out. But you still have to hold your breath, because now you're with the smoke. When they tell you can breathe, then you can breathe.
It's this kind of work and commitment to movie making that makes so many in the stunt industry frustrated that once again this year, they were shut out of the Oscars. You see, despite the fact that the annual broadcast includes 23 different award categories, none are for stunts. But there's one guy who has spent decades trying to change this. So I'm going to start by telling you a story that may explain a bit about the psyche of the man who has spent more than 30 years campaigning to get a stunt category included at the Oscars. I'm Joan Weber, and this is Storylines. In 1979, Jack Gill's dad pleaded with him not to take a stunt job on a Hollywood movie called The Exterminator.
Not The Terminator, but The Exterminator.
That's Jack.
And my father said, I'll pay you to not do it.
Jack and I are on a video call. He's got some photos on the wall behind him, cars flying through the air, and a raft of clapperboards. Those are the things that snap together when the director yells action. I can see one that says Jumanji, and another for Fast and Furious 8. But way back, when Jack gets approached to do this movie, The Exterminator, he's just 23 years old, and he's told five stunt performers have already turned the job down. You see, the director has a vision for the opening, even before the credits roll.
He wants a black screen, and he wants to see his lead character running across the top of a cliff, a mountaintop, at night, and this airplane comes up behind him and drops napalm and blows the entire cliff up, and this guy sails off the top of the cliff and drops in to hit on a downhill, and he's barely alive.
Before agreeing to this, Jack wants to eyeball the location. So he's taken to the edge of this cliff in Valencia, California. And the first thing he notices is that it's not a sheer drop, it's sloped, which makes placing an airbag below tricky. He's told the closest they can get it is about 20 feet or roughly 6 meters out. What that means is to make that jump from that height, Jack's really got to fly outward a long way before he comes down. So he asks for an air ram. That's a stunt tool which looks a little like a ramp, but when you run onto it, it triggers a switch which catapults you up and forward like a human projectile.
And it throws you high and far away, and we use them for explosions.
And for this particular napalm explosion, Jack has questions about what that might look like.
And they said, it's 13 gallons of gasoline they're going to layer on the top and another 8 gallons in the side of the cliff on the way down that's going to shoot out. But we're going to try and direct that away from you. But they want to see you flying through the air with a big fireball behind you and then another fireball that comes out from the side of the cliff.
Jack points out that they didn't have protective fire gel back then, just flame-resistant clothing.
Which doesn't help your face or hands or anything else. So all I could do was wet myself down.
So the day arrives, and Jack's going to do the stunt.
So I get out to the cliff, and it's nighttime.
And he rehearses several times on flat ground. First time works great, second perfect.
And then the third time I tried it, it misfired. And I went to the effects guy and I said, if this thing misfires, does the gasoline still go off? And he goes, yeah, it's keyed into the air ram. The gasoline's still going to fire. And if it misfires, you'll still be on top of the cliff when 13 gallons of gasoline goes off.
This was a line too far. So Jack says, nope, sorry, not going to do it with faulty equipment. So next thing you know, the stunt coordinator, the guy responsible for this scene, is racing home to fetch a new air ram.
And now it's like 4 in the morning. And so I get ready to go with your roll camera. We've got 9 cameras all rolling. And then I hear, cut, cut, cut. Hey, the paramedic down here wants to know what blood type the stunt guy is in case he gets burned. And I went, you know what, guys? Just roll camera. Let's just roll camera and get this over with. And I ran, hit the thing, it fired me up in the air. And when I was up in the air, I felt like the concussion of the 13 gallons of gasoline, I felt like somebody had hit me in the back with the flat end of a shovel, just square in the back, because I felt like it pushed me out a little more. And as I was turning over, I saw everybody running the other direction, and I thought, uh-oh, I'm going to miss the airbag.
When you watch the opening of the film, you can see how Jack manages the force by which he's thrown out in front of this ginormous orange glowing fireball. It almost looks like he's doing the front crawl through an invisible current. Jack hits the airbag perfectly. Apparently, everyone had been running to dodge the fire that was raining down on them.
The director came over and shook my hand, and everybody was cheering and clapping. And I got a whopping $750 for that. So at the time, $750 was a lot to me. And, you know, I kind of made my name in the business from that one stunt. You know, it was something that is an accomplishment that I will always look back on, but never do again.
So the upshot of this story is, don't tell Jack Gill he can't do something. It might explain why, after more than 3 decades of unsuccessfully lobbying for a stunt category at the Oscars, Jack refuses to give up.
Says, dear Don, I am writing to formally request that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences discuss and vote to create a branch and add a category for best stunt coordinator / action designer.
For years, Jack has been sending a version of this letter to the Academy.
Stunt coordinators are an integral and active component of the film industry and have long deserved an Oscar category.
When he started out, he figured it could be a long process, maybe 3-5 years.
Well, I mean, I've gotten so many reasons why over the 32 years that I've been doing this that they've stopped giving reasons anymore because they just can't think up anything else.
Jack's a veteran stunt coordinator now, designing action scenes for movies like Universal Pictures' Fast and Furious franchise. In No. 8, he choreographed a breathtakingly high-speed drag race through the narrow streets of Havana. And he configured a way to make the lead actor look as though he's racing backwards after his car bursts into flames.
To do that, I created a vehicle with a steering on the other side of the car. And then I put another steering cubicle on top of the car, and I put another stunt person, Alan Padelford, who was the stunt person. He drove that car from the roof of the car while it was going backwards.
Like most coordinators, Jack spent years performing stunts. Just before the Exterminator role, he landed steady work as the stunt double for his pal John Schneider on Warner Brothers' The Dukes of Hazzard. Piloting the show's orange Dodge Charger, Jack would do these novel jumps that would become known for how high and far the car would soar.
Dukes of Hazzard kind of started the big car jumps. And so instead of the car being 4 or 5 feet off the ground, the car was now 20 feet off the ground, traveling hundreds of feet. And, you know, when you're dropping a 4,000-pound car out of the sky from 20 feet, your body takes a big toll.
People would sit on inner tubes to cushion the landings, he says. But even so, people were breaking their backs in those days. This was before safety harnesses were invented. Jack got noticed on Dukes and later on Knight Rider. And pretty soon, he was being asked to do motorcycle jumps, falls, crashes for movies like Cannonball Run and Megaforce. And as time wore on, he came to believe it was unfair that movies, which the stunt industry had been heavily involved in, were winning Oscars on ABC's live broadcast for seemingly everything but stunts.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Cinematography.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Visual Effects.
Here are the nominees for Achievement in Makeup and Hairstyle.
Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, Ruth Carter.
To not even be in the show is the tough part about it. That's the really hard part about doing these films. Sometimes we're on these films for 8 months, and then to see all your other peers go up on the stage and accept, and you're sitting at home watching it on the TV.
So Jack started a petition. He got people like Martin Scorsese and Steven Spielberg to sign it. Today, he's got nearly 133,000 signatures.
You know, I'd like to say to the Academy that if you took the chariot race out of Ben-Hur, would it have been the same movie? And it wouldn't have been, because in every single teaser that you see for Ben-Hur, that chariot race is in there.
But none of his arguments, nor his petition, seem to have helped. Despite this, Jack figures the stunt industry is closer today than ever to attaining its goal. It's striking that in 2020, during ABC's Oscar broadcast, a stuntman did manage to score a golden statue.
Here are the nominees for performance.
Only catch? He won for playing a stuntman, not for being one.
Brad Pitt.
This was for his role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But with the world watching, Brad took the opportunity to give a plug for the industry's real stunt performers.
You know, I also want to say, you know, while we're doing all this, I think it's time we give a little love to our stunt coordinators and our stunt crews.
It was great for Brad to say that, because it's one of the things that we say, isn't it amazing that an actor who plays a stuntman can win an Oscar, but yet being a stuntman, you can't win an Oscar.
It's not a good feeling when you know how much work stunt people put into it and how much money those movies make.
This is Monique Ganderton. She's a Canadian who made headlines in 2018 for being Marvel Studios' first female stunt coordinator for the movie Avengers: Infinity War.
You have a chair next to the director. They're constantly looking to you for advice. And you're just such a part of the nucleus of making these movies these days.
Monique now lives on a ranch just outside Atlanta. And so we meet up on a video call.
I'm a tough, very tough person, because just by default, because I grew up in freaking Edmonton.
It's stuff like her dad making her take her driver's test in a prairie blizzard that she credits for preparing her for a career she fell into by accident. She was doing some modeling in Toronto when her agency got her a job as an extra on the TV show La Femme Nikita. There she was starstruck, not by the lead, but by the stunt double.
And she rolled down some stairs and she did this little fight and like shot some people. And then she was like pulling up her, or taking her pads off. And I was like, who is this amazing person? Like,
holy crap. As Monique's talking, I can see why she stunt doubled for Charlize Theron in Universal Pictures action flick Atomic Blonde. She manages to look ferocious in this fight scene, which was filmed inside the stairwell of an old Hungarian apartment in Budapest. The character battles a whole string of bad guys. Monique's particularly proud of this sequence, in part because she helped choreograph it. It's succinctly described online as badass. Monique won several awards for this movie, not from the Academy, of course, but from the industry's own celebration called the Taurus Awards. Like Jack, Monique has opinions on why the Academy doesn't hand out Oscars for Best Action.
I have theories. So let's say maybe, you know, 40 years ago, stunt performers and coordinators barely had a credit in the end credits. you know, stunts has just historically been like a secret.
A secret, because the movie business runs on star power. So what happens when you hand out an Oscar to a stunt double for all the cool stuff that someone like a Matt Damon has been believed to have done? Does that take away a little bit of the Hollywood magic? Jack says this was one of the first reasons he was given by the Academy.
It started out with, well, we don't want the actors to let the public know that they have stunt doubles. And I said, this is not for stunt doubles. It's for the actual stunt coordinator.
His pitch was for the designers of the action to be acknowledged, the way department heads are recognized in other categories, such as special effects and editing. That way, the recipients...
They're not talking about stunt doubles. They're just talking about a sequence that they design. So we got past that. And then they said, well, if we have an action category, we're going to have to delete one of our categories to get the time frame in. And I said, well, why don't we cut down one of the dance numbers or one of the comic numbers for a minute and you could get it in there? And they said, no, we can't do that. So I said, okay, great. Next year, we said, let's say we're not in the big show. Let's say we're in the Scientific Awards, and 2 days before you give us an award, it's not televised, it's in the Scientific Award. And we got shot down there. So then we said, how about we're not in the Scientific Awards? How about it's just an award given in a, you know, it could be a hallway somewhere.
We need to take a quick break. Storylines, we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Prest, and I am here in your ear to tell you about a very incredible new show called Asking for It. Asking for It is a darkly comedic series that follows a queer femme singer whose history of violence finds her no matter how many times she runs away. It has an original soundtrack, and it'll make you laugh, cry, and feel a little bit less alone. Asking for It. Subscribe now.
The notion that stunt performers are perpetually kept in the shadows goes way back.
Well, I'm not the kind to kiss and tell, but I've been seen with fire up.
You might remember this theme song from the old ABC series, The Fall Guy. It describes the woes of the stuntman, who never gets any respect. The stars get all the credit, and the double is the doofus who gets all the injuries. Lee Majors played the lead. The lyrics really sum it up.
I might fall from a tall building. I might roll a brand new car. Cause I'm the unknown stuntman. They ran for such a star.
For a long time, for Monique's family and friends, she was kind of the unknown stunt person. She says her mother
didn't know what I really did for a living.
But that changed when her mom got a job on the same film set as Monique in Vancouver, in the props department.
And she'd never been on a film set before. And I actually had to be like, Mom, you have to bring me my grenade launcher. And they were putting up this big, like, Lexan barrier for the crew, right? So they're putting up these big walls and everyone's like, we got to go around the block, get back. We're going to blow all this stuff up. And so I'm in front of this barrier, obviously, because I'm on camera, and she's bringing me my grenade launcher as everyone is getting like pushed like a block away. And she looks at me and she's like, oh my God, like, this is what you do. And I'm like, yeah, thanks for the grenade launcher, Mom. I'll see you in a bit. Like, and I was like, they blew up like four cars. I swear, I probably couldn't hear, but I swear I heard my mom like screaming, like squealing, and from a block away.
So what I'm gonna do is, if I'm leading, I'm just gonna try and shake him off of me.
In a sparse-looking martial arts studio in Vancouver, Kirk Kayowet teaches fight choreography. Pairs move back and forth in what looks like a kind of aggressive animalistic ritual, or possibly a violent tango. This is how Kirk describes it.
Well, fight choreography, good fight choreography is simply a dance. It's like an expression of violence. Like on the scale between ballroom and martial arts, it's 80% ballroom, right? It's funny, Bruce Lee is known as a martial artist, but his background was in the cha-cha. He was a Hong Kong cha-cha champion.
So part dance, part martial arts, part gymnastics, but the moves must be precise.
Yeah, you have to be quick on your feet to be a stunt person and think fast. Being a few inches off of your mark when you throw a punch and your partner is expecting you to be right there with it when you're doing high-end, fast, you know, Jackie Chan level choreography, footwork is extremely important to it, and that's one of the first principles that we train here.
I'm going to give him a bit of assistance with this foot.
In one maneuver he's demonstrating, Kirk looks as though he's pinned to the ground by a fellow stunt double. But in one fluid move, he uses his foot to push away his partner just as that guy hurls himself into the air in a series of dramatic rotations.
So it's 360, 360, 360.
Kirk has been working here in Hollywood North for decades. If you saw Marvel's X-Men 2, you'll have seen him.
Security breach. Jackie, leave.
He doubled Alan Cumming as the Nightcrawler. His months of training for the film are on display as he backflips and leaps his way through the opening White House scene. For Kirk, the fact that there's no Oscar category is simply a snub. And while nobody gets into this line of work for recognition, he says, it is disturbing when you understand what people have sacrificed.
And we've all been hurt, sure. I mean, I've broken my back twice and my neck once, and I've broken 23 bones and cut a finger off and had to have it sewn back on, and punctured lungs and broken clavicles. And yes, it happens. And the business is getting safer. But I don't think that I've ever run into a stunt person who has been working the business for more than 25 years that has never been hurt. It just, if you're doing stunts, eventually something's going to bite you, and you just hope that it doesn't either debilitate you or kill you. So you leave your family early in the morning looking at their faces, and you can't say anything. You just have to say, I love you and I hope I see you later, and you leave. So it's tougher on your family, I think, than it is on the stunt people.
Jack says computer-generated imagery has been a game changer.
We can put bigger cables on people because they can paint those cables out, whereas before we were having to fly people around the set on piano wire, which was really dangerous.
He tells me safety is another one of the issues the Academy brought up with him in the late 90s.
They said, if we give you an award, what's going to keep action designers from going out there and creating these enormously huge stunt sequences just to get an award and people get hurt? And I said, well, you have to look at special effects as well, because they have that exact same ability and they haven't done that.
I could see someone possibly saying, like, oh, it's going to make people want to do crazier stunts or do, you know... Yeah, maybe, because I'm sure every Tom Cruise movie would get nominated, as it should, because they do stuff that is beyond, like, my comprehension. Luckily, he has a very safe, very good stunt coordinator, Wade Eastwood, that you know, keeps that in track. But I don't think it works like that to make a run for more danger just to get an Academy Award. I think it's more like... You know, like Everything Everywhere All at Once, I think, should have won a stunt award. Like, that was so creative and interesting and unique. So if it breeds creativity, great. But I don't believe there's no stunt coordinator that's like, yeah, I'm going to like try to hurt somebody. Like, that's the opposite of our job.
I wanted to talk to the CEO of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Bill Kramer. But I was told by his communications department that they were unable to set up an interview for the moment. In an email, though, they said stunt coordinators are, quote, a deeply respected part of our membership, and explained that historically, new awards evolve from the Academy's various branches. There are 18 of them, one for cinematographers, one for writers, one for film editors, to name a few. Oscar categories correspond to the branches. So the thing is, up until last year, stunt coordinators didn't have a branch, but now they've got a production and technology branch. It's one of the reasons Jack is encouraged, but at the same time, he points out that this arm of the Academy is not actually dedicated to stunt people. It's more of a mishmash of folks, including script supervisors, choreographers, associate producers, etc., etc. And according to Jack, everybody is vying for their own award. Bottom line, he says, if the Academy wanted to give stunt designers a category, it could do it tomorrow.
If I was the head of the Academy, I would stand up and I'd be like, we apologize for not recognizing you. We've always recognized you under the radar. Here you go.
I hope the Academy understands that people are putting their lives on the line for the public's enjoyment.
And making sacrifices, Kurt Kaowet says, that the public never hears about.
Head injuries have always been our biggest problem because we're performing these things without helmets, of course. We didn't even used to wear helmets in rehearsals. We didn't even know better. Like, I don't know. We don't wear it on the day, so why would we do it now? So head injuries have plagued us.
He says it's well known in the industry that performers will keep concussions and other injuries quiet for fear of not getting work. And they all, Jack, Monique, and Kirk, know performers who have been killed or permanently injured.
One of my best friends, my best friend at the time of the accident, had a safety wire fail and he fell 33 feet headfirst into a concrete parking lot. It was really a miracle that he lived. It was awful. Yeah, he had so many blood transfusions. There's something there that to think that we risk our lives for this industry, and yet it's more important for them to pretend we don't exist than to acknowledge our existence. That kind of hurts. It does. Yeah.
And when you look at films like, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark and True Lies and all these films, and that's the thing that really hurts us more than anything, is that these wonderful films have passed us by, and these people may not ever get a chance to do something like that again.
That's all for Storylines for this week. Today's episode was produced by me, Joan Weber. It was story edited by Julia Poggle. This documentary originally aired on the day of the Oscars on the Sunday Magazine. That's all for Storylines for this week. If you like our show, please leave us a glowing 5-star review and feel free to talk us up to your friends. Storylines is produced by AC Rowe. The show is part of the CBC Audio Doc Unit. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.